Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, an activist in Texas gets his FBI files and finds out that agents have been tailing him for years. Activists in the Midwest are the targets of a wide-ranging investigation, including a half a dozen house raids and an array of subpoenas. And, oh yeah, parts of the Patriot Act were renewed. There's an effort to extend the term of FBI Chief Robert Mueller, and the FBI is giving agents new powers. Can media start connecting the dots? We'll ask Shahed Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Also on Counterspin today, the work of recently murdered Pakistani journalist Saeed Salim Shahzad offers rare insights into the strategic thinking of al-Qaeda, with whose leaders he had conducted many interviews. But how are Shahzad's revelations impacting U.S. journalism? We'll talk to freelance journalist and historian Gareth Porter about Saeed Salim Shahzad. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
After the Republican presidential debate on June 13th, one storyline was that far-right Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann is for real, mostly because she managed to sound, well, a little less crazy than she sounded before. There were stories about the Bachmentum in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and USA Today, all sending the same message. As the Times explained, the key question was whether Bachmann could avoid the gaffes and strident rhetoric for which she is known. The paper concluded, quote, "By most accounts, she did just that. Ms. Bachmann toned her rhetoric down a bit and offered herself as a competent, knowledgeable insider who would nonetheless carry on the fight against big government with the zeal of a Tea Party activist." Close quote. The paper added that Bachmann, quote, "often mocked by late-night comedians and liberal cable hosts as a nutty right-winger, wants to dispel that caricature as she pursues the nomination." Close quote. Well, it sounds like she's doing just that. At least until you turn to the Times editorial page. There, readers learned that the candidates spoke mostly gibberish about jobs and the economy, and one candidate in particular, quote, "Michelle Bachmann had the strangest, most simplistic economic solution of all, simply close down the Environmental Protection Agency, which she said should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America," close quote. I guess if you're writing a news article about how Bachmann toned down the crazy in this debate, you'd have to leave out that quote. It kind of makes it sound like she didn't.
Well, if toning down the crazy constitutes success in a Republican presidential debate, there might be trouble ahead. A June 15th report from the Associated Press explains that CNN's upcoming debate will be co-sponsored by the Tea Party Express. As the AP reported, quote, "The Tea Party movement will be holding viewing parties across the nation, and topics for the debate will be tailored for the interests of this political insurgent movement," close quote. CNN Washington bureau chief Sam Feist agreed, explaining the relationship this way, quote, "It's valuable to the audience, it's interesting to the viewer, and it sends a message that it's not just a debate by and for journalists," close quote. So having a far-right political movement shape the event is better than having your own journalists write the questions. That's a strange thing for a journalist to say, let alone a bureau chief. But CNN has had a long relationship with the Tea Party Express. They embedded a reporter with the group's 2010 bus tour. When Michelle Bachmann wanted to deliver a Tea Party response to Obama's State of the Union address this year, CNN sent a camera to bring that web chat to national television. The Tea Party Express group was booted from a National Tea Party Federation last year over the racist writings of leader Mark Williams. The current leader, Amy Kremer, once defended another racist Tea Party activist and flirted with birtherism. On top of all that, other Tea Party activists have long complained that the Express isn't really a grassroots group at all, but the project of a political action committee set up by two Republican consultants. What CNN is doing associating themselves with these folks is anyone's guess.
Crack open the new issue of Newsweek magazine and you'll see Christopher Dickey writing about the good old days of Arab dictatorships. Dickey tells readers that American spies have nostalgia for a more autocratic Arab world. Quote, "You know, back before dictators started toppling in the Middle East. Back when suspected bad guys could be snatched off a street somewhere and delivered to the not-so-tender mercies of interrogators in their home countries. Back when thuggish tyrants, however ugly, were at least predictable," close quote. One senior intelligence officer tells Dickey that all this celebration of democracy is just bullshit. a view Dickey doesn't seem to challenge much. In Egypt, for example, Dickey explains how Hosni Mubarak's failure to hand over power to his torturing intelligence chief Omar Suleiman was bad news for U.S. policymakers, who may have lost a vital link in their interrogation network. Dickey's explanation, though, reveals a logical flaw. Egypt were close partners in the U.S. rendition program when the Bush administration pushed hard for torturers to deliver the kind of intelligence they wanted to hear, like intelligence linking Saddam Hussein with al-Qaeda, for instance. The fact that such a piece in Newsweek can lament the loss of such intelligence as a blow to U.S. interests is quite a feat.
Republican politicians are under pressure from their party's right-wing base to reject climate change science, as a June 9th Washington Post report reminds us. This is good to point out, but as the story's lead sentence would seem to indicate, the Post doesn't think climate change is very important either. Quote, "It seemed like a straightforward question on a second-tier issue. Would Mitt Romney disavow the science behind global warming?" Close quote. So the fate of the planet is a second-tier issue? According to the Post, Romney's views that humans are contributing to global warming are disturbing to the far right, to whom the paper gives ample space to vent. Rush Limbaugh is quoted exclaiming, "Bye-bye nomination," and adding that, quote, "The whole premise of man-made global warming is a hoax," close quote. Similar quotes from the Club for Growth, conservativesforpalin.com, and Christopher Horner of the Competitive Enterprise Institute follow. But there's no indication that what these people are saying is nonsense. Perhaps the reporter justifies omitting mention of the scientific consensus on climate change on the dubious rationale that it's a story about politics and not science. So the closest thing to a balancing perspective comes in a citation of a March Gallup poll that concludes that because Republicans largely reject climate change and Democrats largely embrace it, quote, "public opinion is politicized," close quote. Using the word politicized to portray as equals views supported by science and rejected by it aids the Post in avoiding the facts and playing down the importance of an issue that just might weigh on the future of the planet.
And finally, journalists covering the NATO war in Libya seem keenly interested in writing stories about the laughable PR of the Gaddafi regime, who can't even manage to convincingly show civilian casualties to foreign reporters. Here are some headlines we saw on June 6th and June 7th. "Libya stokes its machine-generating propaganda." "Libya's PR efforts are falling short." "Libya officials put a spin on conflict." "Libya government fails to prove claims of NATO casualties." It was interesting then to see a report in the LA Times on June 9th from the scene of what would certainly appear to be a NATO bombing of one of Gaddafi's tents. Here's what the Times reported. Quote, "A NATO official reached in Naples, Italy late Wednesday emphasized that the Western alliance does not target people for killings, and the official would not confirm that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization warplanes had even struck the site Tuesday. It doesn't sound like that would be the subject of our attention, so I'm not sure what you were shown there," said the official, who, under NATO rules, could not be identified by name. Close quote. "We probably didn't even bomb that, and we don't target people, but don't use my real name." That is how the pros do PR. Those Libyans sure could use a lesson in propaganda.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
An activist in Austin receives a trove of FBI documents revealing the Bureau's intense monitoring of him over a number of years. The Washington Post reports a serious FBI effort, 23 subpoenas and 7 home raids, targeting labor activists and Palestinian advocates in the United States. At the same time, the FBI is reportedly granting itself new powers. Add to all of that, almost an afterthought at this point, a brief, undercover fight over extending certain provisions of the Patriot Act. If the job of journalism is to present citizens with disconnected anecdotes about the fight to preserve and protect civil liberties, then much of this has been addressed in major newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post. But if you think journalism should do a lot more than that, piecing together these seemingly isolated incidents and connecting the dots, then media coverage of civil liberties should be doing a whole lot more. Joining us now to discuss all of this is Shahid Buttar. He's the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. He joins us now by telephone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Shahid Buttar.
Thanks so much, Peter. Thanks so much for having me on.
Some of these stories and the way they were reported suggest there is certainly room in the corporate media to do coverage that will bother or maybe even outrage readers. You're reading about an anarchist in Texas who can watch the FBI agents sitting outside his house. They set up a camera. They're rifling through his garbage. That's going to seem outrageous to people. The Washington Post story suggesting that there are efforts to tie U.S. activists to foreign groups that are designated as terrorists, so then you can make those U.S. activists material supporters of terrorists. Can you, or should you maybe, try to put a purse string through all of these different stories? Does it tell one big story that we're missing here?
Absolutely. I have no doubt, and I appreciate very much your recognition of the connection. If you look at the Patriot Act, for instance, as a statutory basis for authority, and then the FBI's policy changes to, say, the investigative operation guidelines in 2008 or this week, as adding on to those statutory basis for authority, the particular powers to use certain investigative methods, you know, they fit together. And the whole is much greater than the sum of the parts, or then perhaps worse is the better adjective. You know, the whole is much worse than the sum of the parts. And then you add to that, for instance, the proposed extension of the FBI director's term, which would basically ratify and reinforce this expanding arena of abuses and civil liberties. I think ultimately the string that connects these seemingly disparate news cycles is a simple question, and it's whether or not the United States will remain the land of the free.
You know, reading that Washington Post story about those activists, and I think a lot of people who follow this closely may have felt the same way, that you're reading this and you're outraged, and then you're thinking, was this story reported 6 months ago or 8 months ago or 12 months ago? I think I've heard of this before, but there's sort of, it kind of washes over you because you hear about it and then it's gone.
That's right, and I think the general failure, I'd say, by mainstream media sources to connect those dots and to, quite frankly, maintain a focus on issues in the news cycle that warrants more than merely passing discussion is really glaring. I mean, if you think about the issues, for instance, that do have staying power in the news cycle, very often they're not particularly significant, whereas the very significant questions, you know, whether or not the FBI should be a law enforcement agency or whether we're comfortable with it, you know, turning into the KGB, those sorts of questions just don't even come up. And when they do come up, it's in a very isolated context. And I do fear that a lot of these discrete issues fly over the heads of the American public. And if you think about that grand question we just raised about whether or not the U.S. will remain the land of the free, I think ultimately it's a death by a thousand cuts. And we have already suffered hundreds, right? I mean, these aren't abstract hypothetical future fears that these different news cycles raise. These are in real, live, historical, established issues. And I fear that our lack of attention as a society is really creating a very deep vulnerability in the republic to being co-opted.
Now, journalists, if I had to try to defend their lack of attention or sporadic attention, they say, well, we need a hook to cover some of these things. It does seem like there was a hook, or there is a hook, and you mentioned it in passing, but let's talk about it a little bit more. Robert Mueller is extending, or the administration is trying to extend his term as FBI director. He's been the director of the FBI throughout all of this. It would seem a perfect chance to review his record, something you've written about pretty extensively.
It would. In Congress, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of recognition of the problems that have emerged on his watch. And I think that's a real problem in itself, not just that the FBI is conducting political witch hunts and not just that the COINTELPRO era has been resurrected, but because there's no accountability to the Bureau for those violations.
Is it a partisan issue then? You know, reporters do often, especially in Washington, D.C., wait for one major party to object. We saw arguably more attention to this during the Bush years because Democrats were outraged by Bush-era excesses. Are Republicans going to be outraged by Obama-era domestic surveillance excesses? Is there any evidence that there will be this conservative uprising against this?
A little bit. I mean, you saw in the Patriot Act reauthorization struggle, for instance, while many of the Democrats in Congress who had been critical of the Patriot Act under the Bush administration were casually involved, the member of Congress who most went to the mat to try to defend the Constitution when the Patriot Act was recently reauthorized by President Obama was Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, a Republican. So I think you at least see it in microcosm. And I think the broader point you raised about how at least the D.C. press in particular focuses, and I would even say fetishizes, the partisan debate I think that's a real problem also, and it marginalizes the extent to which we, the people and the public, have access to what I would say is a legitimate policy discourse. Because if you think about it, there's at least two problems here. The first is that the Democrats and Republicans agree on a great many things that are very problematic for the broader political culture. And I think, for instance, the Patriot Act or the FBI's political witch hunt of peace activists and Latino immigration rights activists or labor activists, I think that's a good example of the kind of issue that people across the political spectrum would have concerns about, but you don't see those concerns reflected in Washington.
Now, we noted, I think, a couple of weeks ago when there was that fight over the extending certain provisions of the Patriot Act that a lot of the media coverage talked about the pen Barack Obama used to sign the extension because he was out of the country at the time. I guess it does sound like, and I know the Bill of Rights Defense Committee's work is kind of rooted in local organizing. Is that where the action is outside of Washington and in local or state level communities where people are mobilizing on these issues?
Absolutely. And I think that's a perfect example. You know, I heard a blogger tweet the day of that controversy about the auto pen broke, that worrying about whether or not the president is using an auto pen to re-sign the Patriot Act is sort of like worrying about whether or not you got enough mayonnaise on your excrement sandwich.
Didn't say excrement, I imagine.
He did not. He used much more colorful terms. But I think it points to what I would say is the illegitimacy of much of the contemporary what passes for political debate. I don't know if it's too far to say that the wool is being pulled over our eyes, but I do think that, you know, to the extent media sources provide our lens into current events, we are certainly looking through sunglasses, you know, and they're not prescription, right? So there's a lot that's getting obscured. And your the sort of the latter point about your question, I think, is absolutely true. I think that as long as the debate in D.C. and in Congress and between the two major parties is as artificially limited as it has been, the real opportunity for we the people, I think, is to change that debate by exercising political power and leverage where we have it the most. And I think that the key there is looking less to Washington and more to our city councils and our mayors, because while members of Congress might be very hard to reach, and even if you are able to reach one, they have a great many colleagues that they have to convince in order to make anything happen, both of those premises are different at the local level. You can get to your city council people, you can get to your mayors, and oftentimes they are relatively empowered. Instead of there being 530 other people in their legislature, there might be 10 or 12. And so there are a lot. And moreover, at the state level and the local level, there are a whole series of institutional actors, like, for instance, local police departments, some of which are massive, like the NYPD and the LAPD, right? Those are institutions that you can control through political debate at the local level that even if you were able to win the fight in Washington would still be off the table. Whether it's an African-American community being profiled in the war on drugs or a Latino community being profiled in the war on immigration or a Muslim or Arab community being profiled in the war on terror, increasingly all of those different federal struggles are getting filtered through and effectuated by local police departments. And so I think there's a particular opportunity to assert leverage and force the issue about expanding surveillance, about the co-optation of local police, about privileging the corporate power to sell high-tech instruments over the liberty and privacy rights of law-abiding people. I think it's a good opportunity to get all those kinds of issues on the political table.
We've been speaking with Shahid Buttar. He's the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. You can visit their website to learn more about their work at bordc.org. Shahid Buttar, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter. Take care.
Pakistani journalist Saeed Salim Shahzad was murdered in late May, but he left behind a new book, Inside Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, Beyond Bin Laden and 9/11, which included interviews with leaders of Al-Qaeda and rare perspectives on the group's strategic thinking. Joining us to talk about Shahzad and his work is journalist and historian Gareth Porter, whose column about Shahzad appears at Consortium News and Counterpunch. Welcome back to Counterspin, Gareth Porter.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Well, who was Saeed Salim Shahzad?
Salim Shahzad was a remarkable Pakistani reporter who for the past several years had been the Pakistan bureau chief for Asia Times Online. And in that role, he had been covering the Afghanistan war as well as the internal war within Pakistan. And what he did was to cultivate and to get the widest range of contacts within both the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Al-Qaeda and Tehrik-e-Taliban, meaning neo-Taliban militant groups in Pakistan. And he actually met with really the top strategists, I would say, in terms of operations of Al-Qaeda and the Pakistani Taliban of any foreign journalist, any journalist at all. He had quite remarkable access to them, and they spoke at great length and often to him, revealing, I think, over time, the pattern of their thinking in a way that is really quite authoritative. And that's why his book is really very valuable in terms of shedding light on the way they thought about both Afghanistan and the wider issues of the Islamic world.
Well, let's talk about what he found, the way they their strategic thinking. What are the lessons of Salim Shahzad's reporting, his recent book, etc.?
Well, I think the lesson of primarily that readers can glean from this book is that the Al-Qaeda leadership and their strategists viewed Afghanistan in a much broader Islamic compass or framework than is the normal conventional view of Al-Qaeda thinking. The conventional wisdom that was given out as a justification for the new step up in the war in Afghanistan was that if the United States were to fail, to be defeated and to retreat from Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda and its allies would be emboldened to fight on because the United States was defeated. What's interesting to me is that this sort of conventional view of Al-Qaeda is really a mirror image of the Cold War rationale for U.S. policy, which was, if it was involved in a war or a covert operation, that it had to prevail, because if it did not, if it were defeated or retreated, that communists all over the world would be emboldened by this, and that therefore we would have greater troubles ahead. In fact, the Al-Qaeda strategists who were talking to Shahzad over the years really reflected a very different view. I mean, their concern was not how tough the United States was, whether it was effective in counterinsurgency in Afghanistan or Iraq, for that matter. It was really whether the United States was occupying Islamic lands. Since the answer to that question was yes in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda felt that this was the best thing that had ever happened to them. I mean, in other words, they believed that they could exploit very effectively the fact that the United States was and its NATO allies were occupying Afghanistan, and they did indeed do precisely that. They particularly in the tribal areas of Pakistan, they were able to use the American military engagement and the NATO military engagement in Afghanistan to really bring large numbers, millions of people, into an effective political military organization. What they did was really to create two new Islamic states in the tribal areas of North Waziristan and South Waziristan. And they did so, of course, with the Afghanistan war as the primary recruiting tool for the recruitment of people into this new organization, which they eventually called Tehrik-e-Taliban or Neo-Taliban. And beyond that, of course, the wider aim of particularly Dr. Ayman Zawahiri, who, by the way, Shahzad really regards as the primary strategist and ideologist of Al-Qaeda, not Osama bin Laden. The Zawahiri view was that the real aim of Al-Qaeda should be to turn the Islamic population against their rulers, particularly in places like Egypt, of course, and Saudi Arabia. These were the places they wanted to really carry out an Islamic insurgency, and the U.S. war in Afghanistan provided the fuel for them to recruit people and to egg them on in those efforts.
Well, other journalists have made similar points over the years. As Jim Noricas points out in an upcoming issue of Fares magazine Extra, Abdul Bari Atwan, the editor of the London-based Arabic language paper Al Quds, has made similar points based on interviews with bin Laden himself. And there were also those U.S. reports early in the Afghan and Iraq wars about the CIA concluding that the wars were aiding in al-Qaeda recruiting. Gareth Porter, I think you've already sort of suggested that this information isn't figuring very much in corporate U.S. journalism about, say, the war in Afghanistan. But why do you think this information is largely kept from U.S. readers and viewers?
Well, this is a very important point, and I'm glad you've raised it. Indeed, you know, there were many stories about, at the time, about the U.S. intelligence estimates on how the Iraq War was a very important tool for recruitment by al-Qaeda and other militant groups. This was clearly a major concern of the intelligence community, which was clearly communicated to the Bush administration, and it was covered at the time. But then once the dust settled after these intelligence estimates were circulated and reported on, then it was forgotten, and it did not figure in the continuing press and political discourse on U.S. wars in the Middle East and in South Asia or Central Asia. Instead, I think what has happened is what usually happens, which is that the corporate news media tend to reflect implicitly, if not explicitly, the conventional assumptions of the policymakers in power. And in this case, those conventional assumptions, as I've said, were that the real problem is that if the United States doesn't prevail, it will be seen as a paper tiger and that the Islamic militants will be on the offensive. And of course, I mean, this is really missing the fundamental point.
We've been speaking with journalist and historian Gareth Porter. His piece on Salim Shahzad is available at online locations, including Consortium News. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin, Gareth Porter.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.